From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn how Milwaukee could play a big role in who becomes the next president of the United States. Then Fit for You goes through the results of a new Marquette study that examines who is and isn't wearing a mask.
So females, we found, were about 1.5 times more likely than males to wear a mask, which is particularly concerning because we have evidence that men are at greater risk for more severe outcomes from COVID-19.
Plus, the Milwaukee Public Library gives us a list of book recommendations for adults and kids to learn more about racism.
You know, I've had to, especially recently, have those tough conversations, and I found this book list to be helpful to me in explaining some of those things to my children.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. As we inch closer to the election, the importance of Milwaukee voters is becoming more and more clear. It's the largest city in Wisconsin and home to a large portion of the state's minority populations. In 2016, when Hillary Clinton was running against then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, she was criticized for not stepping foot in Wisconsin. On the other hand, Joe Biden's campaign has visited the state multiple times, and vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris has made a campaign stop in the city. But Biden himself has yet to hold an event in Milwaukee. And while Milwaukee generally goes blue on Election Day, there are no guarantees in an election taking place during a pandemic. Sam Levine covers voting rights for The Guardian, an online international news publication. He recently wrote a piece looking at why Milwaukee could determine Joe Biden's fate in the November election. Levine spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about voting barriers and how this year compares to the 2016 presidential election.
To start with, why do you think Milwaukee will play such a big role in the November election?
Well, there's no question that Milwaukee is going to be incredibly important in the November election. It's the biggest city in Wisconsin, and it's also home to a significant portion of the state's minority population. There's no question that Joe Biden will likely win Milwaukee. It's a Democratic bastion. It's a crucial part of what any Democratic candidate needs to win the state. But what makes it really important this election cycle is that in 2016, there was a really severe drop in turnout. There were about 41,000 fewer voters who turned out to vote in 2016 than did in 2012. And overcoming that drop and making sure that that doesn't happen again is going to be really, really important to determining whether or not Biden can win in the state.
How do you think voter turnout will differ this year compared to 2016?
I think all the signs are pointing towards very high voter turnout. People are requesting mail-in ballots like never before, and there's clearly enthusiasm to vote this year. I think there are a couple factors that are complicating that, though. One big question is voter registration. People haven't been able to conduct voter registration drives, canvass, knock on doors, get people signed up to vote the way that they have been in the past. In Wisconsin, that's a little more complicated because in Wisconsin, you can register at the polls on Election Day, which is considered a very positive step towards expanding the right to vote. But it's unclear how many people are going to feel safe and comfortable turning out at the polls in person. So I think that's one big question, is voter registration. The second is how many people are going to be familiar with the rules around what they need to do to vote. Are they going to know how to request an absentee ballot, how to fill out an absentee ballot, and all the requirements that come with that? In Wisconsin, you have to submit a picture of your voter ID. You have to get it witnessed. And those are all unfamiliar for a lot of people. Wisconsin is not a state where there's been a ton of mail-in balloting before. I think those are all factors that could complicate turnout this election. There are also government offices have been closed, so people who haven't voted before and might need an ID, it's much harder for them to get one. Students might be at home rather than at school and might not have access to get an absentee ballot. They might not be engaging with campus voter registration drives the way they would have under normal circumstances. So I think there's a lot of signs of high turnout, of a lot of enthusiasm, but there are severe and really unique obstacles that we haven't seen before that could challenge that.
How does higher voter turnout influence the outcome of the election? Does it help one party over the other?
I think that there isn't a clear partisan breakdown on this. I think in recent years, we've seen kind of this reflexive attitude among the parties, particularly in the Republican Party, that anything that allows more people to vote and makes it easier for people to vote is going to hurt the Republican Party. And we've seen that play out, that kind of reflexive thinking play out when it comes to voting by mail. Republicans have, for the most part, really opposed efforts to make it easier to vote by mail this year. And the research hasn't really shown that that's true. There are plenty of Republican voters who vote by mail, who senior citizens, military voters, who don't want to appear in person. And in a lot of states, voting by mail has been a really important part of Republican strategy for getting out the vote for years. But we've really arrived at this place here in 2020 where there's this kind of partisan thinking around voting that the more people who vote, the worse it's going to be for the Republican Party. And that kind of thinking has really shaped a lot of the high stakes debates around this that we've seen over the last few years.
In your article, you call out Republican-crafted barriers to voting. Why would that be so advantageous for their party?
I think there's a sense that minority groups, younger voters, students, all tend to support Democrats. And there has been research shown that things that make it harder to vote impact those groups. They might be less likely to have an ID. They might be less likely to be able to vote on election day as opposed to voting early and things like that. And I think across the country, what we're seeing is a changing electorate, changing demographics, and an effort on the part of the Republican Party to freeze out that kind of new electorate, the changing demographics, to make it so that instead of expanding the numbers of voters that they're bringing into their party, to freeze out new voters who could support the other party. So I think that's kind of the thinking around that.
It seems like it wouldn't be advantageous to write off such large sections of the electorate rather than trying to expand, your voting base. Why do you think that that's done?
You have to take a step back and look at the kind of policy positions that the Republican Party has taken on really, in the last few years. This is a party that has really taken an anti-immigration stance, for example. It is not making efforts to bring in Latino and Hispanic voters. And the more kind of dug in you get on those stances, the more kind of you try to play to your base, the people that you know are likely to support you, the harder it is to bring in new voters. And so you start doing things, I think, to protect that kind of core base of people that support you. And I think what a lot of voters I talked to for this recent piece I wrote about Milwaukee is just assuming that voters are going to vote a certain way because they are a minority or because they're part of any other group is really a mistake. That it's really a mistake to just kind of reflexively take the political leanings of any group for granted.
What does it signal or mean for the country if voter suppression is associated with one of the two political parties, but those efforts are still able to continue?
I think it's a really dangerous position for the country. The foundation of power in America is this idea that our leaders are chosen. You know, they govern through the consent of the people. And when we start choosing people based on the vote of not everyone, but just a smaller group, that really starts to bring in questions about the legitimacy of the power that they wield. And when people start to feel like they, it won't matter how they vote, it doesn't matter what candidates they support or what policies they want, it's not going to be reflected in who's in office, we start having a government, I think, that's really far removed from the will of the people, from the voice of the people, and one that really doesn't reflect who we are, and I think most dangerously, that we don't see as legitimate. And when we start not seeing our government as a legitimate one, it raises all kinds of really dangerous questions about the way that laws are made, the way that policies are made. And it seems like we're going down that road where there are questions about the legitimacy of people who are elected and the kinds of things that they're able to do while in office. So I think it's a really kind of dangerous position for the country to be in.
With the pandemic limiting or changing hours and services at the Department of Motor Vehicles in Milwaukee, how do you think the voter ID law will affect voters?
I think it's going to be a huge challenge still. This was something that the 2016 presidential election was the first presidential election in Wisconsin where this was in effect. And just talking to activists and election officials there, there was tremendous confusion about this new law. People, it was tied up in the courts. It was kind of going back and forth. People didn't know the exact requirements that they had to meet. There was kind of a half-hearted effort by the state to run a PSA campaign about it. So people, there was still a lot of confusion. So I think now, here we are 4 years later, people maybe have gotten a little more used to it. They've gotten more familiar with it. But they still don't have access to state offices to get the IDs they need or documents that they need. They might not, just because of the harshness of the economic conditions with the pandemic, might not have a chance to get there and take off the time of work. So I think that it's still going to remain a huge, huge barrier, and that the pandemic has only exacerbated the obstacles that people face.
And how do you think the vote will be suppressed in the general election? And how do you think those efforts have changed since 2016?
I think some of what we're going to see this fall is similar to what we saw in 2016. Voter ID in Wisconsin will still be a huge issue and a huge obstacle for a lot of people. There are also cuts to early voting that are going to happen in Wisconsin this year. I think there are only 2 weeks. The state can only offer 2 weeks of early voting, which is a severe cutback from what localities have been able to offer in the past. And that's going to make it, that just means voters will have much less time to go to the polls and cast their votes. Because many people are voting by mail for the first time, I think there are going to be a whole new, there are a ton of ways that people can have their ballots rejected by mail that don't apply if you vote in person. If you forget to get someone to witness your ballot in Wisconsin, it can be rejected. If you forget to sign, if you forget to date it, if it gets to an election office too late to be counted, your ballot can be rejected. And I think we're going to see tons of fighting around that in the lead up to the election and even after the election. And I think there's also just going to be this effort to from the president and from people who support him, creating this narrative that the election is rigged, that no matter how you vote, it's already been predestined how the election is going to turn out. And that decreases people's confidence in the election results. But I think it also decreases the motivation that people have to go to the polls. If you hear that something is rigged, that it's not going to matter, then you think, okay, well, why should I take the time to go through this whole process to vote? Doesn't matter how my one vote isn't going to make a difference. So I think that's really dangerous as well.
Is there anything else you're paying special close attention to?
I think one thing that's going to be really unique this year that we have never seen in the past is that we're really unlikely to know the winner of the presidential election on Election Day. Americans are used to this tradition where you have Election Day, you have the TV anchors on election night who call the result, the loser comes out and gives a concession, and then the president or the president-elect will come out and give their victory speech. We're used to that ritual. But because there's more mail-in voting, it's going to take much longer for election officials to process the ballots. In some states, including Wisconsin, election officials can't even begin to process the ballots by law until Election Day. And they're going to have millions of ballots to verify and count and process. And that process is just going to take a few days. And there's a lot of concern about what could happen in that uncertain period after Election Day when America is just waiting and there's this uncertainty. The president has made it very clear that he expects there to be an election result on Election Day and has suggested that any ballots that are counted afterwards are illegitimate or fraudulent, which is just not true. These are legitimate ballots that election officials are still going to be counting. So people are thinking about what happens if the president claims victory in the presidential race before all the ballots are counted. What happens if it appears that one candidate is ahead on election night, but the ballot totals shift as more are counted? How do we prepare the public for accepting that possibility, for understanding that that is a normal process? And the worst case scenario I think that could really evolve into is a scenario when it comes time for the Electoral College to meet and there's still uncertainty over who has won a state and who has which slate of electors has the legitimacy when it comes to the Electoral College. And the laws around what happens if that's the case, if there's a conflict, are really, really unclear. And if we got to that point, it would be a really dangerous situation that would really be kind of unprecedented in our history. And so I'm not willing to say that that's definitely going to happen, but that's kind of a worst case scenario. But I think the thing that I'm paying definitely the most attention to is, how do we handle this period of uncertainty and waiting after Election Day that could determine who the next president is going to be?
Sam Levine covers voting rights for The Guardian, an online international news publication. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about his recent article titled Why Milwaukee Could Determine Joe Biden's Fate in the November Election. We'll take a short break, then our Fit for You series finds out who is and who isn't wearing a mask. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Masks are a proven and effective tool in fighting the spread of COVID-19, but some people still resist wearing them. Just last week, Governor Tony Evers extended the statewide mask mandate until November 21st, as Wisconsin's cases of coronavirus continue to rise. Until recently, mask wearing hasn't been studied in the U.S., but a new study out of Marquette University breaks down the demographics of mask wearers and resistors and how mandates impact behavior. Marquette students observed shoppers entering retail stores in several Wisconsin counties throughout the summer to see how gender, age, and location factor into mask wearing. For this month's Fit for You, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski goes through these findings with two of the study's authors, Dr. Sandra Hunter and Mike Heischer of Marquette University. Heischer begins by explaining why they decided to conduct the study.
This came about just from a natural conversation that I was having with Dr. Hunter, and we were kind of talking about masking as a kind of cost-effective protective measure that you could take to slow the spread of the virus. And I was just kind of upset that I wasn't seeing very many people in my area wearing masks. And so I said, most people are not wearing masks. And the great scientist that she is said, where's your evidence for that? And so from that conversation, we just kind of decided, you know, nobody is really studying mask wearing observationally. I mean, you can send out survey data all you want, but self-reported measures are not always reliable. And so we just decided to gather some students that were looking for some work to do and go out into the community and observe mask wearing.
So what was your original hypothesis that you went out into the community with?
Well, there had been some data that had come through from different avenues showing that people were reporting that women were wearing masks more than men, and that older people may be wearing masks more than young people, and that they're certainly at higher risk. And so we sort of thought, well, let's go back and see if there are age differences, if there are differences between males and females. And also let's take advantage of the fact that the students at the time, and this was in late May, were spread out throughout the regional area around Milwaukee because a lot of them were at home doing their studies, and summer was just beginning. And so some of them were out in the country. So we said, let's look at location as well, urban areas, suburban, and as well as rural. So Mike was noticing that in his, where he was living, which was a little bit more rural, that not many people were wearing masks. Where I'm in more suburbia, I was seeing that probably it was about 50-50, that's what I thought. And other people who were living more urban were noticing that there was some mask wearing going on, certainly not at the rates that we'd like for complete elimination of COVID-19, but at high enough rates. And so there's a discrepancy. So that's where it came about. Also at the time, Mike was writing a blog, a student commentary, which was part of a bigger initiative that we had at Marquette around COVID-19. And we called it the COVID-19 Research Initiative. And one of the parts of that was we pivoted to sort of allow students to have a voice in this void of lack of research, and said, okay, well, let's see if they can write commentaries around COVID-19 that can inform themselves and inform us at Marquette and the public about some of the rapidly changing economics and activity levels and some of the impact of the COVID-19 that was occurring. So that's where Mike started this in terms of writing a blog about mask wearing. And then that's where he came out with his famous saying that no one is wearing a mask.
So let's go through the demographics that you collected from doing these observations. So overall, who tends to wear masks more and who wears them less?
So females we found were significantly more likely to be observed wearing a mask. They're about 1.5 times more likely than males to wear a mask, which is particularly concerning because we have evidence that men are at greater risk for more severe outcomes from COVID-19. There was one study where actually 60% of the hospitalized patients were males. And so it's interesting that females are more likely to wear a mask. You know, maybe this is related to them taking more care of the caregiving responsibilities within the household. There's also been evidence that females are more likely to engage in non-pharmaceutical protective behaviors during pandemics and epidemics. So really interesting that we saw this significant difference between males and females, especially, like I said, because males are at greater risk for severe outcomes.
Let me ask, as a man, Mike, do you have any other inklings as to why this would be?
I think, you know, one of the things is just that masks are not viewed as masculine by a lot of men. And so I think, honestly, just designing masks to look more masculine may be effective. I mean, you see males all the time during hunting season wearing masks and on their snowmobiles with their snowmobile helmets. And so, you know, maybe if we can design them to be a little bit more, you know, fashionably masculine, maybe that would help increase wearing among males. But I don't have a problem with it. You won't see me with that one on.
It's really interesting because I was in a store, this is early on in the pandemic, and was wearing a mask, and an older gentleman came up to me, and I'd accidentally taken off with his cart, his shopping cart, and then he sort of motioned to me, oh, that's mine. And he came up to me and he wasn't wearing a mask, and I was sort of backing away. I was. And he said, oh, I imagine you're embarrassed about wearing that mask. I'm just like, no, I'm not. I think that's transference going on here. I think he was embarrassed about wearing a mask, which is why he wasn't, but he was transferring his opinions onto me. It was really interesting. Yeah, it was very, very interesting.
Well, yeah, and this study comes at a time. You mentioned, Sandra, it's very ad hoc the way the U.S. has tried to enforce masks and, you know, have left it to states or regions or other things. And there hasn't been no federally mandated mask as other countries have done. But it's also a climate where people can get not just verbally confronted, but physically harmed in their resistance of wearing a mask. So, it's interesting. You don't really see other countries reporting these very strong reactions to being asked to wear a mask.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's being very much politicized, and there's a lot of tension around that. So I think if we have leadership that and we have a unified front, then I think a lot of this tension would go away. But it's just unfortunate that the time we're in and the leadership that we have, that it's exacerbating any real tensions that people have and beliefs that they have. But if you see that everyone's falling into line, then it just becomes the norm. And there's social pressures around this. When someone isn't wearing a mask and you're meeting them, but you are, and you're having a meeting with them, it already creates a barrier there that we're on different sides of the equation here in terms of the way that we perceive the world and how my safety versus your safety. And so it just creates tension that is unfortunate.
So you mentioned looking at urban versus suburban and rural mask wearing rates. So does the rates differ between counties with low and high numbers of cases or deaths? Because if you're out in rural Wisconsin, population is smaller, maybe you're not seeing the effects of the pandemic quite as much as, say, we are here in the city of Milwaukee. Did you find any numbers that kind of correlated with this?
Well, certainly we found that people in rural areas were wearing masks at less than half the rate as suburban and urban. And the suburban and urban areas were very similar, which I found a little bit surprising. I thought maybe in the suburban areas that they are maybe different, they may be less, but they were very similar. The rural areas are really interesting, and that's what Mike was seeing when he first made these observations, which really started the study around no one's wearing a mask. But the interesting thing is that when you go into a store, you know, it's the same sort of density in terms of shopping, yet people aren't transferring that way of thinking that, oh, now I'm going into a more populated area, I should be wearing a mask. They're just trundling in and taking their beliefs in there and not wearing a mask.
So the evidence suggests, based on survey data, that the case and death rates within a county don't significantly impact the rate of mask wearing. But the differences that we saw between suburban and urban areas versus rural areas are concerning, because a lot of times rural residents have to travel further for medical care. And so they may be at higher risk for more severe outcomes if, you know, they're an hour away from the nearest hospital, for example. In addition to that, if you look at sociological data, populations that live in rural areas are more susceptible to COVID-19. You have a lot of older individuals living in rural areas, more individuals with comorbidities potentially living in those areas as well. So even though we're seeing, you know, significantly lower rates of mask wearing in those areas without mandates, just like with the males, you know, the populations that live in those areas might be at higher risk. So again, concerning.
Through the course of this study, you were able to observe people pre-statewide mandate and after it was implemented. So what did your observations tell you about the either necessity or effectiveness of statewide mandates?
Yeah, so we're able to do a second round of observations. So that first round of observations were in early June, where there were no mandates. And we found that overall 41% of people were wearing masks. So when the mandates, when we came around and did the second round of testing or observations, we didn't actually know that the state were going to put mandates in place. We just thought, well, let's look at what's happening with the in-store mandates. I think Milwaukee had, the urban areas did have a mandate at that stage. So we thought, well, let's just look at the mandates. And at the time, we started about a week before the state mandate came into play. And then, boom, the state mandate came into place. And so we then were able to get to compare, well, what happens when the whole state goes under a mandate, which was just fantastic. The timing was very fortunate. And what we found is that certainly if you were in an area where there wasn't a store mandate in place, that certainly the rates of mask wearing had gone up to about 80%. And that's when there wasn't a store mandate, and that's when there wasn't a mandate in that area. So people were certainly becoming more aware, and this was certainly accompanied by the increase in the rates of COVID-19. So I think there was just a general awareness. However, I went back to one store the day after the state mandate had gone into place, and it went from 80% up to 98%. So people certainly did fall into line even the day after. So there was this rapid increase, although there had been an awareness that mask wearing is probably a good idea, even if I'm not told that I have to. But there were still the holdouts. I call them the holdouts. And believe it or not, even when the state mandate came into place, there were people who would walk into the store boldly without a mask. It was like, not many, but there was the occasional person. And I just found that stunning.
So currently, you're among the first to really tackle these kind of observational studies. And, you know, there's no peer-reviewed and direct observational studies of mask wearing for comparison right now. So how do you hope tracking this information and being some of the first to quantify, you know, what people are wondering and thinking about the rates of mask wearing, how do you think this will help not just the public, but even public health officials, or potentially shaping how we continue to move forward in this pandemic?
So we are one of the first, and I've noticed some other studies have come out from other states. Now they're starting to emerge, and we're being asked to review some of those studies now because there just aren't any out there. I mean, certainly there's polls, but polls are self-reported and people will always tell you what they think you want to hear. So we're hoping that this shows that mandates certainly make a difference, particularly having data before and after the mandates, that we need rates of at least 80 to 90% to quell the spread of the disease. And when people are just left to their own devices, certainly we saw first like about 40%, and that's just not adequate. So we're hoping that now that I think there's 35 states that have mask mandates in place. Correct me if I'm wrong, that was a couple of weeks ago. And so there's still these holdout states that allow people to make their own decisions and their own choices around that. And clearly, while the majority of people feel, you know, some sort of social responsibility, there's certainly the resistors who won't. And so I think this data sort of really backs up the idea that you really need mask mandates to protect each other and to protect the health of the public.
And Mike, how has it been for you to start this with a broad statement, you know, that then Dr. Hunter, you know, challenges you on with some with some facts and data to see it come to fruition and to, you know, have a finished study out of that?
It's been really exciting to be a part of. I think it's, you know, been a really valuable experience for the undergraduate students as well. I mean, just being involved in research at that stage kind of helps you see the big picture in terms of what science is all about. I think that there's a really good chance that we, you know, we could make an impact with this type of research. I mean, even though it would be extremely helpful for the CDC to acknowledge that airborne transmission of the virus is happening, it's still happening. I mean, scientists since February and March, like Jose Luis Jimenez and Lindsay Marr and Kim Prather and Don Milton, have all been pushing this airborne transmission. And so for that reason, you know, mask wearing is critically important. And so, you know, through this research, we've showed that mandates are necessary to promote the practice, and the practice is necessary to slow the spread. And so, yeah, it's been great to be a part of this project, and I'm looking forward to seeing the impact of it in the future.
One of the other positives that has come from this is, you know, at Marquette, we were in this stage where there was very little research going on when we first started this study, and we're able to pivot and just say, okay, well, let's turn this to a research opportunity. And the students just loved it. And like Mike was saying, they were able to see a study go from a question to a finished product. And it was because of the pandemic that this was possible, because we had the time and the opportunity to do it. And it's just been an extremely valuable experience for the students involved in the research.
Well, Dr. Sandra Hunter and Mike Heischer, thank you both for your work and for speaking to me about it today.
Thanks so much, Audrey. It's been such a pleasure.
Thanks, Audrey. A lot of fun.
Dr. Sandra Hunter is a professor at Marquette University and the director of the Athletic and Human Performance Research Center. Mike Heischer is the lab manager at the research center and a PhD student in exercise and rehabilitation science. Both were involved in a recent study of the demographics and rates of mask wearing in southeastern Wisconsin. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Fit for You. And you can explore some of our past segments at WUWM.com. After the break, we'll have a list of book recommendations from Milwaukee Public Library that teach readers more about race and racism. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Right now, many of us are engaging in conversations about race and systemic racism in the United States. In some ways, it's a conversation our country has been having for generations. But our nation's legacy of racial injustice is often obscured by our history books. And that's left some people to ask, how did we get here? And how can I learn more? The answer? Books. Hermione Bell Henderson is the coordinator of business, technology, and periodicals at the Milwaukee Public Library, and she's compiled a list of books to help adults and kids learn more about racism, racial injustice, and how to be an ally. She joins me now to talk about her selections. Hermione Bell Henderson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've compiled a list of books here that are a good resource for people who are just getting into this topic.
Absolutely. These are all resources that can be accessed at the Milwaukee Public Library. And it's like no better time than now to focus on what's going on in the world.
So this first title, very blunt and probably a good starting off point for people. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. So the first book is So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeoma Alu. And it's really a book that focuses on the issues of Black America. It addresses everything head on and discusses topics such as privilege, police brutality, microaggressions, the popular Black Lives Matter movement, and even the N-word. It does so in a very raw and brutally honest way. And it really just gets you thinking about race?
Well, it sounds like something that unpacks a lot of the terms that we're hearing in a lot of different news reports and a lot of different commentators. When they say certain terms, I think some people just, you know, they don't have the education to really understand what's being talked about. And the next title that you have is actually, I would say, one of those phrases. White Fragility is the title of the next book.
Right. So the next title is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, by Robin J. DiAngelo. And what is white fragility? It's really characterized by white people becoming uncomfortable when they are challenged with the topic of race. It focuses on the emotions of anger and fear and guilt. And there's kind of, you know, the two sides of what happens when you have an uncomfortable conversation. You know, you might get defensive and start arguing, but then the other side of that is that you might just go plain silent. And so it really examines whiteness and gives people an opportunity to change for the better and talk about what's uncomfortable and really have those meaningful conversations about race. It also allows people to really disrupt their beliefs, their principles, and just patterns that have been developed over time, not only in their own lives, but through history when talking about race.
So in that same vein, the next title, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, by Michael Eric Dyson, is a title by a Black voice who's been discussing race topics for a very long time. Tears We Cannot Stop really focuses on Black reality. It focuses on facing the difficult truths about what it's like to be Black in America, and really addresses how long that Black reality has really just been ignored, dismissed, and discounted here in America. It gives us a better understanding of the world that we live in, and that if we actually do face reality and the difficult truths of what it means to be Black in America, we can really go deeper and begin to take action to address finally what needs to be addressed.
Now, this next book, it has actually a local tie-in. I think people will be familiar with the author James Cameron as the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum. This is an interesting title in part because it's such a personal story.
Correct. So James Cameron, in his book, A Time of Terror, A Survivor's Story, really gives that first-person account of his 1930 arrest. At the time, he was 16 years old, and he was out with his friends, and a mob got them and terrorized them and lynched his two friends, and he was nearly lynched, but he was fortunately able to escape. It's a very powerful story. And later in life, James Cameron went on to, again, like you said, become the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum and really tell his story as a civil rights activist. So, you know, it wasn't too long ago. And for him to be able to share his story before he died, again, was very powerful.
And for people who might not be familiar with this incident that happened, it actually is a very famous photograph, the photograph of his two friends who were lynched. And it inspired a very big song, Strange Fruit.
Yes, it did. Very inspiring.
Yeah. So this next book, perhaps aptly after talking about A Time of Terror, is called Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption.
So Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, by Brian Stevenson, has really grown in popularity, especially since the movie is out. It really gives you that great visual representation of the book. The movie now features Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx, but the story is the true story of Walter McMillan, who was convicted and sentenced for a crime that he didn't even commit. And so Bryan Stevenson was the lawyer, and he's a very influential lawyer who's behind the Equal Justice Initiative that has exonerated innocent death row prisoners. I believe at the time of this and just the current work of the Equal Justice Initiative, they have freed over 135 wrongly condemned prisoners on death row. But the story of Walter McMillan really just sheds light and is one of many true stories that highlights racism and our broken justice system.
Yeah. Now, this next book, I have to say, I really enjoy the title, in part because I think, you know, as somebody who is a white person in America and who grew up in a predominantly white area, sometimes, you're just a little stupid about things. You're just a little ignorant about things. And I like that the title is How to Be Less Stupid About Race. Like, you're still going to be a little stupid about it, but let's be less so.
Right. I picked the title just because it was a little fun, even though it is a heavy topic. But Crystal Fleming, the author, really gets down to helping us understand the historical roots of white supremacy, helps us draw connections between, you know, past racism and present racism. And then at the end, she is able to help offer 10 steps to help dismantle systemic racism. So a deep topic, nice and light title.
Well, and with that in mind, one of the things that we wanted to do inside of this list was include titles that would be accessible for teens and even children. And the next few titles all speak to a younger age group.
Correct. I know as a mom of two black kids here in Milwaukee's, you know, the most segregated city in the nation. You know, I've had to, especially recently, have those tough conversations. And I found this book list to be helpful to me in explaining some of those things to my children. The first one is Not My Idea, a book about whiteness by Anastasia Higginbotham. And it's the story of a white child who sees a TV news report of a white police officer shooting and killing a black man. And they talk about, the mom says, hey, in our family, we don't see color, but the child sees the colors very plain and simple. And so the story talks about uncovering the truth of white supremacy in America. But it's tailored very nicely because it's a book that's geared toward ages 5 through 12. So it goes deep, but it's still simple enough for the youngest readers.
Now, this next title is pretty blunt. Racism and Intolerance. Is that an overview more for children?
Yes, it is, I would say. So Racism and Intolerance by Louise Spilsbury really helps children get answers to the questions like, what does it mean to be a racist, or what does it mean to be intolerant? And then how can I help? So children begin to understand the ways that others struggle with these issues. Everyone who reads these titles or this book can, you know, start to or become empowered to make a difference. So it's also a call for action for our young readers.
Now, this next title called Let's Talk About Race, it seems like a good, again, kind of an introduction for kids.
Right. So Let's Talk About Race by Julius Lester talks about race, but in poetic form. So it's a nice poetic introduction to the topic of race. There's a discussion about differences and
unique features of races that can be celebrated while also discussing the important bond that everyone shares with one another. And then there's also discussion of, you know, we are bonded because we're human beings and, you know, we have many common similarities. So a great discussion that's geared more toward ages 6 and up. So again, a very good read for the young children.
Well, this next title on the same idea of poetry is Say Her Name, Poems to Empower. What I like about this title is I think sometimes when we talk about topics that are as serious as racism, intolerance, racial discrimination, we can tend to lean away from the artistry of writing that I think often pulls people in. We tend to lean on nonfiction for very obvious reasons, but I like that this includes some of the artistic part of this dialogue.
Right. So Say Her Name, Poems to Empower by Zeta Elliott focuses on 49 poems, and some of the poets who contributed to this were inspired by the greats. So Nikki Giovanni or Phyllis Wheatley or Lucille Clifton. This book was also inspired by the Say Her Name campaign. So they pay tribute to victims of police brutality in a very uplifting kind of way, with themes talking about self-love, Black resistance. It helps people and readers peek into the mind of what's it like to be a Black woman in America. And, you know, we hear through the protests and we hear through, you know, all these stories of police brutality that, you know, don't forget our Black women. So that's very important to shed some light and focus on Black women who are also going through the same things here in America. I like this book because it offers messages of hope and resilience to young readers. Like you said, also in a very creative format. So, you know, when we think of our young readers, we think about them wanting to express themselves in their own creative ways. So hopefully this type of book and poetry form will also inspire young poets as well.
Yeah. Well, Hermione, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much again for having me. I appreciate it.
Hermione Bell Henderson is the coordinator of business, technology, and periodicals at the Milwaukee Public Library, and we spoke with her earlier this year. You can find more about the books we discussed at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.